From the WisconsinVegetableGardener.com, this is the Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener Podcast. I'm Joy Barry.
I'm Holly Barry.
Coming up on the program,
we're going to do Potatoes 101, everything you need to know about growing potatoes.
Mike Novak will be with us with his environmental report, your questions, our answers.
And our guest, all the way from Mississippi, he is a permaculture expert and he runs a hobby farm, Jared Stanley.
All that and more coming up right now.
Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener Podcast is permeating into your ears with your host, Joey Barry.
And it could be the weeds. Some gardeners try to get all the weeds out of their garden. Other gardeners leave them in their garden. It's really a decision that you need to make. There's benefits to both sides of that. It's just something that you need to figure out what you want to do for your garden.
And Holly Barry.
Canning is a science. When you're canning, you want to make sure you follow the directions, follow the recipe, don't cut corners. Don't replace things. It's crucial to you, your health, and your family.
They're professional gardeners with full-time jobs, and they're on the air now.
Welcome to the Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener Podcast, podcast for the health-conscious organic gardener worldwide. I'm Joy Baird.
I'm Holly Baird.
Behind the TWVG microphone here in southeast Wisconsin in the WI Garden Media Studios. The information you're going to hear in this podcast is crucial and vital to the success of your garden. You just may have to tweak some of the dates and times you apply that information for based on where your growing zone in your garden is located. If you're tuning in for the very first time, thank you very much. Welcome to the program. If you want to find out and check out our previous podcast, you can find all that information at the WisconsinVegetableGardener.com. Underneath that podcast tab, you can see last year's podcast, you can see the topics and the guests. We always have great guests in the program, don't we? Holly's nodding. They can't see you nod. Always great guests in the podcast, as well as today's guest. If you're tuning in, you have no clue who we are. Well, we don't know who you are either, so we're on equal terms. But Holly's going to take a few moments here and tell you who we are and what we do, so we better understand each other and where we're coming from.
So, we produce a lot of videos. How many do we have now?
We're close to 700 how-to garden-related videos
so
on our website.
How-to garden-related videos that include canning and what to do with the food you grow, saving money, finding free resources, all sorts of good stuff. We have that on our website. And then we also have our quarterly digital magazine where we produce that quarterly. It's a full-color magazine. It's
free,
online.
Free.
It's free. It's free. And you can download it. You can print it. You can read it right there. And then we also have this podcast.
And something new that we have...
Oh, and something new we have, Periscope.
Periscope. If you are not familiar what Periscope is, we don't either. Okay, basically what it is, it's a live streaming app. If you have a mobile device, excluding your desktop computer or your laptop, mobile device, tablet, etc., you can find us on Periscope. You can go to our website, see the little Periscope icon, click on it, follow us, and you can watch us live and interact with us live as things are happening when we broadcast. The downside to Periscope, the benefit is doing the live interaction with all of you. The downside is those videos are only housed on Periscope. It's just the way the system is set up for 24 hours. But don't worry, there is a program that we have found that all of our videos go to. Some people who Periscope will put them on YouTube. We're doing differently. We're putting them on what they call Catch Me, and that's on our website as well, and they're posted as well on the website, so you're not going to miss anything. And these are not long videos. These are 5, 10, 15-minute how-to real quick tip videos. So if something you want to check out, if you want to join us on Periscope, that's something that we're excited about. And we also do live streaming on our Facebook page, the Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener. You can find that on Facebook. Very easy to do. Mm-hmm. Just type it in the search engine. Now that we got all that out of the way, we welcome you again. And we're going to talk about potatoes. I think potatoes are a staple in most gardens. Now, in one of the Periscopes that I did not too long ago, I had six vegetables that everybody should grow, and I had potatoes in honorable mentions along with garlic. Mm-hmm. The reason why I'd done that was because if potatoes are one of those crops that it's very universal. You can grow it in ground, traditional ground garden, raised bed garden, and container gardening. But based on your soil density, consistency, and nutrients, the success that you may have versus your neighbors or the other side of your garden can be dramatic.
Yeah.
with that. And that's why I put an honorable mention, because it can be frustrating. Wonder what did I do wrong? And it could be you didn't loosen your... Well, we'll talk about all that. But that potatoes is something. And there's so many varieties of potatoes that you can pick from. Now, you don't want to just go to your Mega Mart and buy some potatoes off the shelf and grow them. We've all heard this, that most big companies that deal with potatoes that sells to the grocery stores for consumption are sprayed with a chemical that prevents them from sprouting. If you go to a organic store where this is not the case and you bring them home in about a week, if not less, you'll start to see eyes appear on these potatoes. Those are perfectly fine to put in the ground and grow. There's nothing wrong with that at all. It's just you kind of want to you might want to know a couple of things: what type of variety they are, what type are they, early variety, mid variety, or late variety, so you know how to where to plant them, type of thing. So we'll get into them. We get all of our seed potatoes from a family owned and operated organic farm in Bridgewater, Maine. You've seen it on our videos. You've seen it on our website. It's called Wood Prairie Farms. You can find, I think most of their potato varieties, they have 26 specialty variety potatoes. Most of them are sold out, but they also have other stuff. It's not just potatoes, but we believe that that's one of their sole focuses is the seed potatoes. Woodprairie.com, spelled as you would the words. So we have six varieties that we're working with. We've never had, we have great success. So let's just talk about the basic understanding of a potato. Potatoes want to be grown in the cooler portions of the season, when temperatures in the soil are not below 45 degrees Fahrenheit. If they're below 45 degrees Fahrenheit, these potatoes will set in the ground and rot. So first of all, you got to know when to plant them.
Right.
Also, varieties are type of growing styles. There are determinate potatoes and indeterminate, because they are part of the nightshade family. Tomatoes are the same way. So you also want to know how the duration of time it's going to take for these potatoes to grow. Early varieties are 50 to 90 days. There's some, I think it's Kennebec. I'm wanting to say it's Kennebec. I may be wrong. They're like a 50-day potato. And you 90 days, 50 to 90 is early variety. 90 to 110 is mid variety. And a long variety or late variety is 110 to 130 days, which that's a good chunk. 130 days, that's 4 months and 10 days, right? Mm-hmm. So that takes up a lot of time in your garden. Now, some people have said, well, I'm in zone 6A. Can I grow? When's the latest I can start potatoes? Well, here's the story. And I don't know every growing zone. I don't know the ambient temperature and the soil temperature in every growing zone. I'm still trying to figure out here in 5A, 5B. Here in 5A, 5B, our soil temperature never exceeds 85 degrees Fahrenheit. The reason I say 85 degrees is because no matter what stage of your potatoes are in, when the temperature hits and exceeds 85 degrees Fahrenheit, your potatoes will die.
Right.
Just what happens.
They don't like hot weather.
They're not a sweet potato. Sweet potatoes are phenomenal in that, but these are normal potatoes.
Okay. So when you're prepping them, first you want to sprout them.
People will chit them or sprout them. That means set them in ambient light and allow the sprouts to appear. You can put this in. You get these potatoes at the grocery store, and they do it on their own. So it's not that difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're having challenges with this, put them in a paper sack, not plastic. Paper will allow them to breathe. Put them in a paper sack, and just leave the sack slightly cracked at the top. In about a week, these potatoes are going to be stretching for light, and they're going to be they will be putting shoots out or sprouts out. Now, you want to sprout these about a month before you're actually going to put them in the ground, because you don't want the sprouts any more than 2 inches. And you don't want to break your sprouts off either, because the potato has to go in a recovery mode,
mm-hmm,
in order to generate another sprout, because that's where the new potato is going to come from. So let's talk about dividing them. Some people don't even believe in sprouting them. They just take the potato, put it whole in the ground, keep going. Okay, so let's talk about, we've sprouted our potatoes. Now what's the step we need to do prior to planting, about 3 days?
Okay, so you divide your potatoes. Now, you don't want to make them smaller than the size of a small chicken egg. And so what you do is, say you have two sprouts on your potato and they're a good distance apart from each other, you can cut in half. Or if you have a really big potato, maybe you cut into thirds. And then what you do is you do that a couple days before you're going to plant them, so they can callus over that fresh flesh, will gain like a little scab over it, and then you can plant them. Now, when you plant them, you want to plant them with their sprouts up, facing up towards the sky, as best as possible. Obviously, for whatever reason, you can't get it perfect. That's okay, but you want to give them a little encouragement there. Now, you can plant your seed potatoes without sprouts, but having the sprouts does give you a head start.
Now, some people will take and cut their potatoes and put them in a powder, and I'm not going to quote what that powder is because I don't want to. I think I know what it is, but I'm not going to say it because I'm not 100% certain. We've never done anything like that, but we have allowed the potato to dry, like Holly talked about, so it doesn't. So it's a harder density, so insects don't get in there and just gouge all that flesh out. Now, a question that we had come across, and we're going to get to questions and answers in the next segment, but some of the questions that we had in regards to potatoes was, one, why do you divide them? One, for more potatoes. And the other question was, should I or can I soak my potato before I plant it? Well,
I never heard that one.
I told the individual no, and then he came back and said, well, I'm going to do it anyway. With further research, I was able to locate that in the olden days, people would soak their potatoes because the potatoes back then had a very dense, dry, hard skin on it because they would save them from year to year, like in the barn, and they didn't have proper storage temperature control, so these would be very dense potatoes. So they would soak them overnight in order to soften the skin, then they would plant them. So we don't need to soak the potatoes. The skins are very thin and fragile as is. Just divide them and you can put them in. If you're going to add any fertilizer, you want good compost. A little lighter on the nitrogen, if anything. If you're going to add any fertilizer at all, a phosphorus fertilizer is best because that's going to encourage good root development, and roots is what you need for potatoes. They'll also produce good flowers as well. And now the depth of planting. As I talked about earlier, potatoes come in two varieties, determinate and indeterminate. Based on the variety of potato you have, some potatoes will actually put sprouts on up the stem as you heal it. You'll see these articles on Facebook and other social media sites. Build a 4x4 box and get 100 pounds of tomatoes in 4x4 area. I've never seen any successful results in this, possibly because they were using the wrong variety of potatoes. And other potatoes will, let's say, and I'm picking a number here, well, you'll plant them and you'll heal them up, and they'll only produce potatoes in a root zone of 4 to 6 inches, 4 to 6 inches height. They're not going to put potatoes on anymore up the stem. So you're wasting a lot of time and soil. So you need to kind of do research on the type of potatoes you have on how best to grow them. You can dig a trench if you haven't opened a lot of soil left. If you're in a container, I would go ahead and just bury them deep and then put soil around them and work the way up the container based on the type of potato you have. You can heal them. Let's talk a little bit about, before we get into the end of the segment and get into Mike Nobok's environmental report, let's talk about planting real quick here.
So planting, you want to space the rows a foot apart, and you want to space each potato in that row about excuse me, a foot apart also. You want to plant them 1 to 3 inch deep, above the soil, and
then as they grow, then you'll heal them up. Now, if you're in limited, like a container, you can go ahead and just put them in the bottom, put some soil in the bottom of the container, and then fill it up as it grows. Anything else there?
For planting?
Yes.
That's pretty much it. Now, we can talk about finding them, but when they harvest.
Let's talk about a little bit about harvest and storage right now before we close out the segment.
So you know your potatoes are ready to harvest when the plants are dying back, the top plants are dying back. They'll turn yellow, brown, what have you, and die back. And then you're ready to go ahead and harvest them. When you harvest the potatoes, you want to use like a garden tine or a garden fork. Because if you use a shovel, you have a larger...
You're going to cut a lot of potatoes.
Yeah, you have larger odds of cutting them. Not necessarily, maybe...
I don't know. I always cut potatoes when I had a shovel. I didn't cut very many with a fork.
Maybe you're an old pro. Okay. But, I mean, not you, but... I mean, maybe we have old pros listening. So that's pretty much it. Then you pick them out of the garden. You throw the top plant away because it is... I think it's poisonous, isn't it?
Poisonous, yes. It's non-edible. If you see... And then you harvest them, and how do you store them?
Well, we leave the dirt on ours because it keeps it, like, as a little, I don't know, barrier, I guess, yep. Against the air and rot, whatever causes rot, air and sunshine, pretty much.
Moisture.
So, yeah, that's how we store them. And you go, cool, dark, dry place is good. Some people put their potatoes in the fridge. Whatever you like to do, that's how you can store them. And then you're pretty much done. And if you're a root cellar, you could do that too.
Real quickly, on the potatoes, as they grow, based on the variety, you may see little balls or little tomato-like a fruit on it. That is poisonous. Do not eat that. That is a true seed potato, and it can be with some work. You can grow an actual plant from that, but again, it is recommended to grow them from the cuttings of the roots of the tubers from the seed potato. But that's what that item is. Most animals will not eat those because they know it is poisonous. So with that being said, if you got any more questions in regard to potatoes and how to grow them, you can find the question button on our website, thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com, and you can send us a question. We'll be right back with the Environmental Report with Mike Novak. What you feed your plants and soil matters. Tomatoes should be big and juicy, but not at the soil's expense. Age-old growth, bloom, kelp, and fish and seaweed, reliable fertilizers, gardens by supplying the plants and the soil with fast-acting nutrients and natural ingredients to create delicious plants and healthy soil. If you desire juicy tomatoes and healthy soil to grow them in, visit ageold.com for more information on Ageold and our suppliers.
Do you want your next raised beds to be easy, functional, and beautiful? The Embrace helps you create the garden you've always wanted. Finally, raised beds that everyone can assemble and enjoy. No tools needed. Just slide any lumber into the Embrace corner, fill with your favorite soil mix, and you're ready to plant. Made from 100% recycled steel right here in the USA. And a portion of every sale helps to build school and community gardens all across the country. Let the Embrace help you create your next raised bed. Grow beautifully with the Embrace, available at local garden centers and online at artofthegarden.net.
Looking for a fast-acting, non-toxic weed killer for your organic garden? One that works in cool and cloudy conditions as low as 40 degrees and is highly biodegradable with visible results in less than 2 hours? Then look no more. Avenger Weed Killer has it all and more. Made from oranges, Avenger is highly effective, easy to use, and has a pleasant citrus aroma. It is OMRI listed and approved for organic gardeners under the USDA's National Organic Program. Avenger Weed Killer is the choice for organic gardeners and homeowners who are looking for an effective, safe way to control unwanted weeds. Available in ready-to-use sprays and concentrate, ask your local lawn and garden supplier for Avenger Weed Killer. For more information and a list of suppliers, visit AvengerOrganics.com. Avenger Weed Killer, eco-friendly, deadly to weeds.
Now back to two gardeners that understand where you're coming from.
Are you a lazy gardener? It's okay if you're a lazy gardener.
Joey and Holly Bear.
Welcome back to the program. If you want to check out our sponsors, you can visit our website, thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com. You just click on the podcast tab. Support them because they support us.
Those links will also be in the show notes below. Well, each show we are very excited to have Mike Novak come on with his environmental report. Congratulations, Mike, on your new radio show in Chicago. Q4radio.com, I think, or .org. He'll tell you about that. He's going to do a follow-up on a previous segment in regards to seed libraries, a happy ending there, as well as politics and the environment. Here's Mike Novak.
And now to a man who's not afraid to tell you what you need to do to keep the planet he lives on clean.
Food scraps out to your compost pile. Screw in a compact fluorescent light bulb. Turn on a window fan instead of an air conditioner. Low flow, baby. Shower heads and toilets. Take one napkin at Starbucks instead of six.
Mike Novak.
Welcome to another installment of the Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener Environmental Report. I'm Mike Novak. And you might notice that, I'm a little nasally this week. I got struck down by Mother Nature in the form of a virus or bacterium. I'm a whole lot better, thanks for asking, but I'm going to keep this short anyway. First, a follow-up to my last report about how seed-sharing libraries are under attack for apparently violating state seed laws. The problem is that those laws are meant to regulate commercial outfits, and seed libraries are anything but. I used as an example the Joseph T. Simpson Public Library seed library in the town of Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania, which was in danger of shutting down. Well, just a few days after my last report, I received word that the Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture has clarified that seed libraries and other non-commercial seed exchanges are not subject to the cost-prohibitive licensing, labeling, and testing requirements required of commercial seed distributors. See how easy that was? Actually, it wasn't, because it took the efforts of a coalition of concerned organizations and people. Keep an eye out for restrictive seed laws in your own state. Go to legalizeseeds.org to sign a petition to the directors of all 50 U.S. State Departments of Agriculture. Now I'm going to talk about the upcoming presidential election. Don't worry, no endorsements. But I am going to call to your attention a lack of interest in the most pressing problem facing the earth today. No, I don't mean how did that Facebook heart symbol end up on the dwarf planet Pluto. I'm talking about the fact that there have now been 20 presidential debates. It only seems like 2,000. During that time, Media Matters reports a total of 1,477 questions have been asked. Of that number, only 22, yes, you heard me correctly, 22 have been about climate change. If you're keeping score, that amounts to a whopping 1.5% of the questions asked. Two networks, ABC and PBS, have not asked any questions about climate change. PBS? Are you kidding me? Shame on you, PBS. 9 of the 20 presidential debates have had no questions about climate change. Fox News, CNN, and ABC each moderated two debates that did not include a single question about climate change. Fox Business, PBS, and CBS each moderated one debate without a climate question. The NBC stations did slightly better. You know who did the best? Univision. Yep, the American Spanish Language Broadcast Television Network. But even they asked only 7.1% of the 1.5% of total questions about climate change. You know what? I have a headache. I'm going to grab a hot toddy and place some sandbags around my home in anticipation of sea levels rising around my ankles. That's it for today. I hope you catch the Mike Novak Show Sunday mornings from 9 to 11 a.m. Central Time on Q4 Radio, www.quenumeral4.org, which you can always link to at my website, mikenowak.net, MikeNowak.net. Go green or go home.
Well, there you go. So let's get into, thank you very much, Mike. Let's get into your questions and our answers.
If you have a question, you can email us. Just go to our website, thewisconsinvegetablegarden.com. There's a little, what color is that button?
It's a red button that says question.
It says questions, ask us when, and we won't divulge your information, but we will definitely ask your question. We'll reply to you, too, so you're not having to wait around. And then we might use it on the air.
And if you want to record your question, you can do that by the send us a voice message button.
And you don't—it's not a voice message; it's a voice recording.
Okay.
And you can do that. You don't have to make a call. You just do that through. You just click a few times, and then you.
And then we can use the audio on the program. Mm-hmm. So let's talk. We got three questions, so we're going to have three answers. The answers that we give are not probably going to be—it's going to be our answers. That's what we do. We give our answers.
And plus, we can't.
Between the two of us, we have approximately 35 years of experience.
So, and if you're vague in your question, then we'll just have to
be vague in our answer. Yeah. So question number one is, I've seen pelleted seeds. What are they? And do I need to cover them with soil when I plant them? Okay, first of all I'll explain what pelleted seeds are.
That may help.
Yeah. You've got heirloom seeds, hybrid seeds, organic seeds and GMO seeds. GMO seeds are agricultural seed that you and I will never be able to buy because we're not signing contracts with big seed companies. pelleted seeds are a new thing that's on the market here that are designed for two primary reasons. Pelleted seeds are coated with a clay-like substance or material, sometimes organic, sometimes not, but it is designed for two specific reasons. One, to be more unified in the seed in order to go through a seeder, and two, in order for you to handle the seed easier for small seeds such as carrot, celery, and lettuce seeds. Pelleted seeds are primed seeds, which means they put them in water and get them primed until the seed coating is about ready to pop. They remove the seed, dry it out, put the coating around it, and sell it to you. What this does is, as soon as moisture hits the seed, it will increase the speed of germination. The down part about this is those seeds are only good for the year you bought them for. Because they've primed them, they are no longer viable after one year because they put them in water, soaked them, pulled them out, dried them, coated them with this clay material, and then you grab them, put them in your garden and grow them, and they sprout very quickly. So these seeds are ready to pop at any moment, and they only got a shelf life of 1 year. So for the money that you're going to spend, unless you're going to plant everything in the seed package, because you've got a seeder or a large garden, this is not the type of seed I would recommend for you. I would recommend just the small seeds, sprinkle them, and thin them out, okay? Also, the pelleted seeds, you'll also see some seed companies have pelleted seeds in neon colors, which are more easier to see. And when you're spacing them, you can see a white or a hot pink or a neon green color in the soil. But again, these seeds are not good for more than 1 year, so keep that in mind. What's our next question?
Okay, so we have this is a question about rodents. How to keep rodents away from raised beds? And if I remember right, they were digging.
They were digging under the beds, yeah. And burrowing up into the soil in the grow medium. Now, it depends on, one, where you live, because they make devices. Some companies make devices that go bang and take care of animals that are annoying. But if you're in an area where you can't use a tool that goes bang and take care of an animal, or you choose not to, there are some other methods to do this. There are scent repellents. They are not a sponsor in the program, but Cedar Creek Organics has a line of products that is a scent repellent that will stay fragrant for up to 6 months based on what type of device you purchase from them, whether it's bulk or bag. You can also take, it really depends on if you can pre-make your beds, if you haven't made your raised beds yet, and you know you're going to have a gopher problem. There is what they call hardware cloth or gopher wire that you put underneath the bed to prevent the rodents from chewing and crawling up under. It's a metal that will prevent them from burrowing up into your beds. If the beds have already been created and you are in an area or you choose not to use a device that goes bang to get rid of them, you can trap them. You can also do some diligent work and dig a foot around the raised beds and put this hardware cloth or this gopher cloth, it's a metal fiber, vertical in conjunction with the bed, so it's a foot down, and then cover the soil back up. So whenever the rodents or burrowing animals try to burrow up underneath the bed, they're going to burrow and they're going to hit this metal fencing, and it's going to prevent them from going up underneath your bed and destroying your bed from the bottom side up.
Yeah. You could also take a bucket if they're like mice or chipmunks. Take a bucket, build them a 5 gallon bucket, fill it, I don't know, probably a quarter of the way. Make a little ramp, put some nuts on the ramp or put peanut butter at the top, and then they'll fall in and they'll drown. And it's probably not the most humane way, but maybe you don't want to own
Sometimes you got to do stuff.
Maybe you don't want to own something that goes bang or you don't feel comfortable. Maybe you're a bad shot. I don't know. But anyway, so that's our good rodent question. Now, here's another question. We recently talked about intensive gardening, and somebody asked, how do you determine spacing for intensive gardening?
So intensive gardening is, let's give an example for, I'm going to put numbers out there so it's easy to talk about. Let's say you got zucchini.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say, and this is not the right number, I'm just putting it out there so it's easy for us to all understand together verbally. Let's say each zucchini plant is supposed to be 4 foot apart. Intensive gardening would tell you, would instruct you to put those zucchini plants, instead of 4 foot apart, 3 foot apart or 2.5 foot apart. So at the time of maturity, the tips of the plants have grown over top of each other slightly and has become a shrub or a canopy over the soil to utilize, and this can be fill in the blank, any type of plant you want, you're growing, tomatoes, peppers, eggplant, any number, fill in the blank. But the ideal is to ignore the recommended spacing rate, spacing for these plants, and to plant them tighter and closer together to allow a whole canopy at maturity to exist for a few important reasons. Now, there are some downfalls to this, but the reasons why you may choose to want to look into a more intensive planting is you're going to get more plants in that row. You're going to have a canopy over top of the soil.
That's going to naturally mulch the soil.
Naturally
retain water.
Retain water and smother out weeds from preventing sunlight from getting to the soil. The downside to this is
it can be too wet, so which that can cause things like fungus, especially, what's that called?
Powdery mildew.
So especially with those kind of plants, they are susceptible to that. And then also the diseases could spread faster if there's a disease.
It's something that, you know, if done correctly, it can be done in a perfect scenario. It's great. And, you know, if you want to do intensive gardening, take a corner of the garden and do that with. I wouldn't recommend doing a quarter or a half. Experiment with it. And that's what we've done, and that's what we do each year. We take a little portion and say, I know this ain't right, but here's what we're going to do. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But we learn from it. But intensive gardening, it's one way to really get more vegetables in a row. Now, for example, let's take cabbage. You really don't have a whole lot of problems with cabbage with a fungal disease. You have more of a cabbage moth disease that worm will eat the internal portion, so if you net them and everything. But you could really cram a whole lot more cabbage in a row, or broccoli or cauliflower in a row, versus something you would want to do like squash, where it'd be more susceptible to that powdery mildew that would kill the plant eventually, in most cases, if you don't control it with a fungicide, homemade or store-bought.
Yeah.
So, if you've got a question, send us...
We got one more.
Oh, no, that's it. We've got three. We've done three.
Okay.
If you... is there anything else on there?
We don't have.
Okay, let's finish that one out.
Yeah, we only did two. Okay. So, what is the best way to establish a vegetable garden in a new place that is presently grass and weeds? So, you could go a couple ways here.
So, new garden, bought a house, got grass in the backyard. How do I start a garden?
So, I think the first thing I would determine is what kind of garden I want to grow. If I was going to garden myself, I didn't have Joey's help, I would grow raised beds. And I would probably grow raised beds. I would put a little bit of money into it, and I would grow raised beds that are maybe a little bit higher than ground level, and I'd make them look nice and cute and pretty. The reason why I would grow raised beds is because a lot of times you have less weeds. I would do some containers, and I would do a combination with the straw bales as well. But raised beds, if you don't know what's in your soil, if you don't want to turn the soil over, you can just make a nice garden, put your own compost in there, or bring in compost, and then that's what you have. If you're brand new to gardening and you want to turn the soil over, I say by all means go ahead, but I would start with maybe like 2 4x8 plots, and then once I see how that goes, I would go from there. What would you do?
Depends on what time of year I bought the house.
Okay.
If it's early in the spring, I would go ahead and get a soil test to figure out if the soil is safe, and it doesn't have poison in it, lead, for example, or like an old gas toxins of some sort. Then I would go ahead and dig the soil up. If I bought the house in early June, I would get some compost, make some raised beds, put a weed barrier, which would be 2 or 3 layers of cardboard, mm-hmm. on top of the soil, and that would smother out the weeds. As we talked about, if I know there's rodents in the area, or prior to that, I would put a rodent barrier on that raised bed to prevent them from headaches from later on. And then I would go ahead and put a raised bed, and then the following year I would go ahead and dig the soil up. That's what I would do.
Now, no matter what size soil you're digging up, whether it's a foot square foot or 2,500 square feet, you always want to call Digger's Hotline, and you want to call them 72 business hours before you dig. So not just 72 hours, but 72 business hours before you dig. And that's something that you have to do legally. If you don't do it, you're breaking the law, and you could also shock yourself, or who knows. So you just want to make sure you go ahead and do that.
So with that being said, if you got a question, send us a question. We'll get you an answer. Coming up after the break, Jared Stanley from permasapien.com and jnjacres.net talking about raising animals and feeding those animals to the kids and the reaction that those kids had. And we'll talk a whole lot more about starting a homestead and raising animals and gardening right after this.
It's all about the soil at ManureT.com. With their grass-fed, antibiotic, and growth hormone-free cattle and horses, owner Annie Haven puts the quality in her premium soil conditioner. 100% organic and natural, whether feeding your flowers or veggies, indoors or out, you can grow organically with confidence. To purchase authentic Haven brand manure tea, small orders or large, go to ManureT.com. Always free shipping!
If you could double the life of your raised bed boxes by sealing the wood with a non-toxic wood preservative, would you? Well, now you can with a clear, penetrating product called Internal Wood Stabilizer. It's 100% non-toxic and easy to apply. Seal your bare, untreated wood surfaces, even chicken coops, by spraying Internal Wood Stabilizer. It's invisible, seals the wood from the inside out, and never wears off. Recommended by organic gardening experts, Internal Wood Stabilizer. Check it out at timberprocoatings.com.
A gardener knows that the key to a good plant is its roots. With poor roots, the end result is not good. Conventional pots and trays cause roots to wrap around and become root-bound. Then you try to unwrap the roots at the time of planting, hoping not to break them. But never again with the Root Maker, a non-chemical innovation that naturally air prunes roots to create more vigorous roots. Never a root-bound plant again. Whether trees, flowers, or edibles, home garden or commercial grower, more roots means healthier, more productive plants. To get your own, visit rootmaker.com.
This is Jeff Radke from the Lost Skills Podcast. You can listen to me at lostskillspodcast.com. Now back to the Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener Podcast with Holly and Joey Baird.
Well, welcome back to the program. Feel free to check out our sponsors on the podcast tab on our website at thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com. Support them because they support us.
Well, let's go to the TWBG hotline and bring in our next guest. Let's go down to Mississippi, where our next guest is the host of J&J Acres on YouTube, as well as the website under the same name, and YouTube channel Permasapien, and the website under that same name. We're going to figure out what that word means in just a moment. And Jared has a large family and a small homestead. And he takes us on his journey through gardening, maintaining livestock, and taking care of the land and letting the land give to him what the land will offer him and his family. Welcome to the Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener Podcast, Mr. Jared Stanley.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you guys having me on.
So let's start with this, Jared. Many people aspire to have a homestead much like yours, large or small, and they have children. You have five children of your own. And you have livestock. How, and let's not talk about what you should do or shouldn't do, but how did you address to your children that, yes, these are animals, these are cute, they're fun, they're fun to play with, but essentially this is food and this is what we're going to eat? And how did that conversation go down? And how did the children accept this information?
Well, you're absolutely right. I cannot tell anybody how they should do it because every child and every family is different. So the way it went down for us might not be the same way it goes for you. It might not be the right way for you to bring it up with your family, but maybe it gives you some ideas. So for us, the way that we handled it is we sort of played off of the children. We were surprised that one day when we were cooking dinner, the children just asked us, where did the vegetables come from? Where did the meat come from? And when they found out we had bought them from the store, they literally sighed, like, oh, they were disappointed that it didn't come from the farm. And so then one day, months later, we had some chicken with dinner, and it was a chicken off of the property, and the children actually cheered. They were excited that it came from the property. Or when we had steamed carrots one day, and it was carrots off of our property, they were excited about it. Excuse me. And the way we decided to manage that, because on the other hand, we do have livestock that is part of our breeding stock. They become pets that stay around for a long time, if you will. You get to know them a bit more. It's not part of our consumption. And so kind of our general rule we've accepted on the property, and the kids have really taken to it, is if we name an animal, if we give an animal a name, like you would call a dog Fido or whatever else, the named animal will never go on the dinner table. And so that helps with things like if we have a rabbit for dinner, they know it's not going to be Rose or Orange or Blueberry, which are the names of our rabbits. They know it's not those rabbits. They know it's one of the ones that was always going to be dinner, and so they don't have to. They don't have to have that concern, which was another thing that we took a cue off the children. One of the younger ones asked one day whether or not that was Blueberry we were eating for dinner, and we said, "Oh no, sweetheart, no, we're not going to eat Blueberry." And it was from that moment on we decided any animal with a name will not go on the dinner table. So if we had an animal pass away that was named, we would give it a burial. We'd take it out of the property or use it somewhere else where it can go back to nature the way it would always be and not put it on the table in front of the kids.
Great. That's, I think, a really good idea. Now, your website is permasapien.com. What is the what's on the website, and what's the idea behind it?
So a year or so ago, I decided that I wanted to be certified in what's known as permaculture. And I'm sure most of your listeners have heard the word. Maybe they don't feel like they have a full understanding of what permaculture really is, but they have an awareness that there is a type of system out there that's called permaculture. And I sort of found my way into permaculture. Just one thing led to another, and eventually I heard this word permaculture, and I started studying about it, and I said, I want to take a full course and be certified as a permaculture designer. And so that's what I did. And then part of being a certified designer and having a homestead was to think about how I could perhaps have a business side to the permaculture and not just rely on things like producing eggs and vegetables and things like that from the homestead, but also be available as an instructor and as a consultant through my permaculture certifications. But I wanted to keep the two separate. By that time, I already had a pretty good following on YouTube. People were used to following us around and just seeing what we were doing on the homestead in general. And I didn't want to completely change things and say, we're going to a 100% permaculture all the time kind of channel. And so I decided to split the thing and say, we're going to keep our homestead information over here, but if it's strictly permaculture related, or if you want to contact me about permaculture related things, then let's do that over here at Permasapien. So Permasapien is a funny little word coined by myself, and it is built off of the same concept that the word permaculture is built on. Very quickly, permaculture is a combination of the words permanent and agriculture. So we want permanent agriculture rather than the year in and year out cycle that we're kind of in right now with conventional farming. We want to look for a permanent solution, permanent agriculture. And so you smash the two words together, you get permaculture. And I wanted to do something similar to that. I wanted the word perma to be a part of this new business entity, if you will, and started brainstorming for ideas on what that would be. And one thing that I've noticed, and it's not just related to permaculture, it's related to just about any kind of subject you could get on, it's not always a matter of just knowing the subject matter of a particular thing. It's knowing how to implement what you learn wisely. Knowing is one thing, doing is another. And if we don't do the doing properly, then the knowing can actually cause damage rather than repair and rejuvenation and regeneration like we want to do in permaculture. So I took the term Homo sapien, which in Latin is actually translated to mean wise man. And I thought, well, this is pretty good. In permaculture, we talk a lot about how mankind interacts with nature and our impact on nature and how we can be a part of the system and not be something that's damaging the system. And I thought, well, this is a pretty good mix. We'll take wise man and match him up with permaculture. And so I smashed permaculture and Homo sapien together and came together with Perma sapien. So the idea behind the name Perma sapien isn't just to use permaculture, but to use permaculture wisely.
Well, let's talk about a little bit about using permaculture wisely. For people who have a lot of land, or for that matter, a minimal amount of land, we want to be stewards of the land and let the land give to us instead of just keep take, take, take. You did this on your property. You watched where the water was running, and you created what was called swells. Now, explain what swells are, and then you also had a problem with the swells that you're going to have to kind of redo them.
So the easiest way to explain a swale is for someone to just to imagine a ditch. It is a depression in the soil, and then on the downside of the hill from the trench that you dug is the dirt that you took out of the hole. So if you were to look at it from left to right on a sheet of paper, you'd see a straight line and then a divot down and then a hill up, and then we'd come back down to the straight line. And the key behind swales is that they are what's called on contour, or they are level on the land. So even though your land may sway around, have rolling hills and things like this, the swales are always on level. So if you were to fill them with water, one side of the swale would be level with the other side of the swale. And there's a lot of benefits and reasons behind doing it. There can be swales with very minimal grades. I'm talking like 1% grades, so that we can slowly let water off on one particular side and things like this. There's a large number of reasons for why you would do swales. There's also some reasons why swales would be inappropriate on a certain property. Most of what we're trying to do here is get water back down into the soil. Rather than letting, in my area, I've got 55 inches of rainfall a year, which sounds like a lot, but it all comes at one time. We have plenty of drought times as well, and we want to get that water into the soil where we can keep it around longer, rather than letting it run off the surface and go into the rivers and not be able to reclaim it on our property again. So what I decided to do is, in our front yard, we had a small area where I wanted to put in a couple very small swales. Swales can be very small, and they can also be extremely large. I'm talking, you know, we can have swales that are, you know, 6 inches in width and depth, and we can have swales that are 20 feet in width and, you know, 4 or 5 feet in depth, and they can get very big. Just depends on, like you were saying before, the acreage and the use for it, whatever the actual purpose of having them there is. Well, I put in these swales. They basically, my measuring was the width of my shovel. So they were basically 1 foot wide for the ditch, and then, of course, another 1 foot wide for the hill or the berm that's on the downside hill of the ditch, and about the same depth, one shovel deep. And all I was trying to do was retain some water so that I could grow some dwarf fruit trees in this area. The problem that I ran into that you alluded to is that in my effort to try to maximize my soil, I had put in a whole bunch of compost. I had put in a whole bunch of annual clovers, because they were going to fix nitrogen more quickly than perennials at the time. so I could get some plantings in there more quickly. As I did that, I neglected to take first, almost rule number one, if you will, in permaculture, was to take a better observation of what was around me. If I had taken a better observation, I would have realized that I had a very invasive type of grass called coking grass. And so with this new fertility found in the soil, this already invasive grass just took off. And as soon as my annual clover died and the sunlight got down into that down to that soil, the coking grass just completely sprouted up. And now I am suffering with a situation where my swales are completely covered in coking grass. I've got it basically choking out fruit trees. And I'm going to have to go back and try to find some ways to combat that issue because I didn't observe properly in the first place. So we got a lot of ideas that we're trying. People can go to the YouTube channel if they want to get into the gory details. We've already got one trial underway, and I think we're going to move over to the next trial here pretty shortly. So if they're interested in that, please come join us.
Great. So you went through the Master Gardener program, and you had some idea of what you were going to learn what it would be like, but you were also surprised by some things about what you had learned. What are some of the surprising things that you had learned?
Well, when you go to the Master Gardener program and you start talking to other gardeners about that you're going to go through the Master Gardener program, you start to be cautioned that it's more of a sales pitch than it is a learning experience, that you're going to be required to talk to people about specific products, just to not be too blunt, but also not beat around the bush, that you're going to have to recommend chemicals, commercially made chemicals, to combat issues where somebody from my line of thinking would rather encourage somebody to investigate ways to let nature help correct the problem. What I ended up discovering and actually going through the course is that, yes, there were certain places where they took the effort to tell you about what chemicals could you be used to combat a particular disease or a pest, but I thought that they were very fair about making sure that they said things like using it minimally, of course, they highly stressed following package instructions and labeling and all those kind of things. But they did a good job balancing that it wasn't something to go to first. It was a last resort. And that when you do go to it, it needs to be treated very tenderly. And mentioning that they said it doesn't come first, what really surprised me is every topic that we went into throughout the Master Gardening program here in Mississippi, they specifically addressed the organic methods first. The first thing we started talking about in soil health wasn't about how to calculate petrochemicals going into the soil. It was how to build organic matter into the soil. And we spent a good bit of time on that. And then it was, okay, and if we need to supplement, then here's how we supplement, and here's the dangers of supplementing, and a lot of good information like that. So that's what surprised me. I went in there because of what other people had told me, expecting that I was going to get the big actual commercial on why you should use our products. And instead what I got was, here's how we do things organically, here's how we can use products, but here's the concerns of using products, so let's, if we use products, do them in a very specialized way.
Now, I want to ask you about, you know, your experiences with livestock. A lot of people, as we talked about a little earlier, that people want to have a homestead, they want to have livestock. You have rabbits, ducks, goats, horse, pigs, bees. Out of all of those animals, what has been the hardest or most labor-intensive animal to raise? And do you ever wish that maybe if you knew now what you wish you would have known then, you wouldn't have raised this certain particular animal? Or has it just been a very great learning experience across the board?
Well, I think it has been a good learning experience across the board. There's certainly been times where I had enough frustration where I said, oh, why did we ever get into goats? You know, about the fourth time they break out of an enclosure, you start to wonder, why did I ever get into goats? But then once you have found a containment system that works and things hit a flow, and then eventually you have fresh goat milk every day, you start to appreciate having gone through the trials so that you could reap the reward. And I think that follows true for all of the animals in one way or another, but probably because of quantity and not because of the animal in itself, you know, the species or the breed or anything like that, but just by sheer quantity, the ducks are a very overwhelming thing for us. And we have two goats. We have three American guinea hog pigs. We've got one beehive right now. Those are all very low quantities, but when you start talking about having 200 ducks hatch on your property in one season, or then at the end of the season you talk about processing 100 of those ducks to go into a freezer, just by the numbers it becomes very overwhelming. And more so because homesteading for me is still an ambition. I think most people are perfectly aware that I don't stay home. My homestead is not my job yet. I have a 9-to-5 away from the property, and when I come home at night before the sun happens to go down, or on the weekend if the weather happens to cooperate, I get to do these things that I enjoy so much. And so because my daytime hours are limited because of my career, it becomes even more burdensome to say, okay, when are we going to butcher these 100 ducks? Let's do it this weekend. And then by the time the weekend comes, you have thunderstorms. And it's like, okay, now what are we going to do? You know, so you got to buy feed for yet another week to keep up with all the poultry. And it just drags on sometimes. And so that can be a little bit wearing. But I wouldn't go back. What we do instead is take lessons learned. We've learned that our property, we have about 7 acres, is not suitable for us to raise out 100 ducks at one time. It might be there are ways that we can improve on the property, things like installing a pond so that the ducks aren't reliant on little tiny ponds that we build or kiddie pools and things like that, but can have a more natural environment. More pasture for them to be able to find insects and seeds and things like that, then maybe we can get the property to a point where we can annually pump out that amount of meat in ducks. But right now, we're not to that point, and so we've learned that lesson, and that means that this year we're taking less ducks through winter. We're being more cautious about our breeding program for them in this year, 2016, and being more responsive to people who ask to purchase ducklings. You know, we were a little conservative in 2015. We told some people, no, we're reserving these ducks for our own use. And then later, we ended up having even more hatchings, and so we had more ducks than we expected. It was not our intention to have 100 ducks for us to have processed. So we'd probably be a little more giving when it comes time to letting the ducklings off the property, knowing that we can always hatch out some more if we need to.
Great. Now, we will end with this. As a father of a large family on a small homestead, what do you hope your children will take away from being raised on a homestead?
Well, you know, I think that there's always something in a parent that wants a child to follow in their footsteps, no matter what their career field might be. So, you know, a part of me would like to see 1 of 5, I think that's pretty reasonable odds, 1 of 5, to decide, I like this kind of lifestyle. I'm going to get away from all of the hustle bustle of the world, and I'm going to find a piece of land that I can pay off very quickly, build my own home, and make it sustainable, and live on renewable energy, and provide my own food, and make my own money so that it, for the necessities of things that I can't barter for and things like that, and not have to be stuck in a system where every 2 weeks I have to get a paycheck or I starve. And if that message can be seen by one of the children, then I'll be very excited. as it stands, we have, of course, all the kids are very, very young still. Our oldest is just about to turn 13. All of them have some sort of interest in the farm. Some of them flat out say, when I grow up, I'm going to have a farm and I want to be a cook. You know, they want to grow the food that they then cook in their own restaurant and provide to people, which is certainly something that is done. So you know, they've got some pretty good ambitions. But if anything else, even if the grand the design doesn't happen and one of the children don't decide to live a very strictly self-sustaining lifestyle, I hope, if nothing else, they've learned a lot of life experiences from having to be responsible for caring for creatures and being in awe, watching plants grow from a seed and feeling the satisfaction of taking care of the soil, planting the seed, taking care of the plant, and then getting to cook or eat the plant one way or the other. And just that full cycle, I think, is a very rewarding thing, and I hope that it's something that sticks with them for the rest of their lives.
Absolutely. Jared, we greatly appreciate you taking time out of your day to join us today. For those who want to venture over and see all your journeys on YouTube and your websites, what's the location that is best for them to journey to?
For YouTube, you can go directly to youtube.com/JandJAcres. That's spelled out JandJAcres. And the website is the same, JandJAcres.net.
And we will have all of those links in the show notes below. Again, Jared, thank you very much for joining us on the program. We greatly appreciate sharing your knowledge with us as well as our listeners.
You're very welcome. Thank you again for having me.
And we'll be right back after this.
Oh, yeah. What you say? You say Nasala Kombucha. It'll put some glide in your stride and some pep in your step. Nasala Kombucha. Yeah.
Nasala Kombucha makes your body happy. Nasala Kombucha makes your body smile.
At DollarSeed.com, all of our seeds are only a dollar a pack. And we have online resources that teach you all about the rewarding hobby of growing your own plants, flowers, herbs, and vegetables. Imagine the joy you'll feel when your children actually help you harvest your first garden crop, or the pride of knowing you'll never need a florist again. Visit DollarSeed.com and grow a little magic of your own for just a dollar. DollarSeed.com. What could be healthier?
Water is our most important resource. The key is to capture the rain that falls on your property. No need for bulky rain barrels that are hard to handle and just don't fit in. Rain Reserve has solved the problem for you. With their multi-size and color cube-like units, a rain barrel that does not look like one. Capturing rain easy, going unnoticed by passerbyers, and blending into the surrounding. Construction so easy, even children can put it together. To get your Rain Reserve, visit rainreserve.com. And use coupon code RAIN2016 to save 10% on total purchase.
Hi, I'm Douglas E. Welch from A Gardener's Notebook at DouglasEWelch.com. Whether I'm out working in the garden or dreaming of gardening during the long, cold winter nights, I love to hear what's happening in the garden with Joey and Holly Baird on the Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener Podcast.
Welcome back to the program. If you'd like to find out more information about the sponsors you've just heard and our entire sponsor lineup, find them at our website, thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com. And those are underneath the podcast tab, and all that information is in the show notes below as well. So we've got one more thing. We're going to wrap the show up a little early just because our last couple shows have been a little long, so I want to keep it, you know, in a timely fashion. We've got gardening in 2 minutes, and then we're going to talk a little bit about a couple things, and we'll close the show out. So Gardening in 2 Minutes is an audio production that Holly and I produce on a weekly basis for a couple of radio programs and a handful of podcasts. If you would like Gardening in 2 Minutes on your particular program, contact us through the website. This Gardening in 2 Minutes is all about...
It's all about planning for canning, getting ready to can, what you need to plan for, and getting yourself prepared.
And here
is Gardening in 2 Minutes.
This is Gardening in 2 Minutes. We grow a garden, we harvest the produce, but what do you do then? Old-timers would can the food up. That is becoming more and more popular now as we want to know where the food we eat comes from. So in order to can the food, we have to have the means to know what we need before it's time to can.
One of the first things that most people can are usually asparagus or strawberries, or strawberry jam, strawberry syrup, strawberry what have you. So the good thing is these things usually come about in May or June, sometimes sooner depending on where you live. So it's good to be prepared and know what you have available. I've been in a point myself where I'm making jam and I realized that I have a lot of filled half-pint jars and not a lot of empty ones. So I'm scrounging around for jars when I could have just planned ahead. Same thing comes for sugar, lids. Anything that you use in canning is good to plan ahead. Lemon juice.
Pectin.
Yeah, I was looking through my pectin. I have pectin that expired in 2013. You don't want to use expired pectin. That will not end well.
And clear gel.
And even clear gel. That's another good one for pie filling. So these are some things to think about. Take a look through your pantry, through your canning supplies. If you've never canned before and you're like, this is the year I'm going to start to can, I would encourage you to check out our videos, check out some great resources online, such as Ball Canning and the Natural Center for Home Food Preservation. And definitely just think about, plan ahead, be prepared. As I always say, be prepared, not scared. And you can come up with a lot of stuff and you can be ready, and you can a lot of yummy stuff from your garden.
Spend a little money now so you have everything you need rather than going to the store and possibly losing that batch that you have worked hard to try to can. For more information on canning, our weekly video productions, as well as our free downloadable digital quarterly magazines, you can find all that information at
TheWisconsinVegetableGardener.com.
For the health-conscious organic gardener worldwide. For Gardening in 2 Minutes, I'm Joy Baird.
I'm Holly Baird.
There you go. Have the items you need when you are going to use them so you're not scrambling at the last minute going, hey, I got 27 quarts of something here and I don't have enough of product X. Yep. So before we get out, we want to thank you for tuning into the program. We bring these programs to you in the hopes that they do help you and bring you some entertainment as well as education to that. And as we expand our media production with live streaming on Facebook and Periscope, we hope to interact with you more in that form of communication. The whole goal of what we do is to teach you and help you grow better food, more food in smaller spaces, and to prevent you from making the same mistakes that we have made. You got anything else you want to add? So until next time, I'm Joy Baird.
I'm Holly Baird.
The audio you have heard on the program is courtesy of SSFSX.co.uk and AudioNeutronics.com, two royalty-free and copyright-free websites we use to help liven up the podcast.
With the exception of Nest Ala and Dollar Seed, they provided their own audio.
So until next time, we will see you in the garden.
The Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener Podcast is a production of the WisconsinVegetableGardener.com for the health-conscious organic gardener worldwide and distributed in association with WI Garden Media.